Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, Jody Dean will tell us why we need a serious left political party, and then Kishama Sawant will tell us about her run for city council in Seattle as an open socialist. First, Jody Dean. Jody, who teaches political theory at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York, is a prolific author. Her most recent book is The Communist Horizon from Verso, which she talked about in Behind the News last October. She insists that all this spontaneous anti-party stuff that's been so popular in the left for the last few decades is a serious mistake. Here she is to explain why. Jody Dean.
Party, Jody. What's your concept of a party before we start talking about why we need one?
I think my basic concept of the party is as a form for generating political will, solidarity, and a sense of commonality among the disparate political actions that have been so separate on the left. So it's primarily, I have in mind something formal, right? I don't think that it makes sense to think about a party for us now by beginning with, oh, it has to have this set of rules and this kind of structure. I think first, just to think conceptually, what kind of form do we need to build left power so that we can really present an alternative with the possibility of changing the world.
That's a noble goal. Yeah. Now, we've, of course, for, 50 years of the New Left, or since the New Left was new, there's been much revulsion at the idea of a party. It means authoritarianism and all that sort of thing. I'm sure you've heard the critique. What's your dismissal of it?
The party, look, first I've got to concede. Yes, there have been authoritarian parties on the left. That's right. There's also been a great deal of authoritarianism and exclusion in multiple small groups, right? The problem is not that the party form by itself requires authoritarianism. When we have that in our political and social interactions, it comes from a variety of different loci. So I think first, it's important not to kind of romanticize horizontality as if all of those interactions are somehow egalitarian and open and cooperative, when we know that, in fact, from Joe Freeman's famous work, there's a tyranny in structuralists, and there are creations of unaccountable sorts of leaders and unaccountable kinds of exclusion, and a great deal of paranoia because people think that there's stuff going on that they don't know about. And most of the time, they're right. There is stuff going on that they don't know about because the people who have good ideas, who are basically in charge, don't feel any kind of need or obligation to tell everyone else. A party makes us have to think in terms of accountability to one another, in terms of making the people who have more decision-making opportunities, make them accountable to other people, make people who take on tasks more accountable. So I think that essentially the accusation of authoritarianism is a little bit of a non-starter. It takes what is an appropriate historical critique in certain contexts and makes it into a kind of rule of living. Oh, these structures are always authoritarian, and that's just false.
Now, you've said in response to, you sort of alluded to this, that even in apparently structuralist organizations, there's a hidden hierarchy, and that hierarchy is often based on charisma, many other pre-existing characteristics, and that a party structure would just acknowledge that hierarchy. But in the allegedly structuralist organizations, keeping those hierarchies hidden is the condition of their existence, right? Like they can't, once you make those explicit, the organization will fall apart.
And I think that might be why people who think of themselves as anarchists or think of themselves as profoundly committed to horizontalism might be afraid of something like a party or might be afraid of organized politics, because then the kind of authority and maybe even glamour that they have would dissipate. They'd have to be much more responsible for it.
Yeah, there's no accountability in a horizontal structure. So if you've got these unacknowledged hierarchies,
yeah,
what do you do?
Well, what criteria can you use to tell them, okay, tell people you're not doing something? I mean, it all becomes, at least in my experience, what happens is it starts to become overly personal. It starts to take on character. People start to think of what's happening in an organization in terms of existing models of exclusion. For example, people might think that that what's happening is because of racism, or that what's happening is because of sexism, or what's happening in the organization is because of homophobia. And it couldn't be right. That might be true. It also might be that there's no accountability in the organization. And so the existing patterns are just taking over. And the people don't mean it in any, you know, they're not consciously racist. They're not meaning to be racist. Racist or meaning to be sexist, but it's happening, and they don't have a way, because they don't have a kind of more accountable party-like structure, they don't have a way of dealing with it.
Yeah, because so the pre-existing social hierarchies take effect.
It seems like there's
no one talks about these things openly.
I think so. It's got to be the case.
And so you have these schisms and resentments and bitterness and lots of process.
Lots of process, right? I mean, do we really need to spend 90% of our meeting time going over the dynamics of the group? Might it not make sense to, in fact, have a kind of organizational structure that would say, okay, you know, here's responsibilities. You are elected or chosen to do these things. And if you don't do these things, then you are demoted or kicked out. And if you act in this way, you are demoted and kicked out. And we don't have to talk about this every meeting about how are we all relating.
But one of the aspects of life in Zuccotti and similar encampments a few years ago was that it wasn't just about the process of the organization, but they were prefiguring a new society. What do you think of that notion of prefiguration through encampment?
First, let me say what I admire about what folks were doing, and that was really breaking out of patterns of life that said, oh, we can't do anything but, you know, forward email or, you know, send people videos on Facebook. They met face to face. They broke out of a way of acting that was saying, I'm too busy, which means I, you know, have to get home and watch television or something like that, and really change their everyday way of life. And that's amazing. That's amazing. That's great. That's also not a politics that even a substantial, significant numerical minority can participate in because of work and responsibilities. And so I think that this idea that we can prefigure a world, and that the world is prefigured as 20 hours of meeting a day and talking about every aspect of life all the time, that's actually not a very functioning world. I mean, that's not quite a world that I don't want to live in that world. I don't want to do politics 20 hours a day. And if that's what's prefigured, that seems to me to be a bad prefiguration. I think better, what about distributing tasks, having a plan?
Division of labor.
Division of labor. And the thing is, I think that division of labor for some on the left is a bad term, but it doesn't have to be that resources are distributed to people on the basis of their place in the division of labor, right? That one person is a better writer and another person is a better cook and another person is a better speaker doesn't mean that any one of those people should have more responsibility or more goodies than anyone else, right? So I think division, that we've gotten a kind of confusion that division of labor somehow means a permanent hierarchy or a division of goods on the basis of a position in the division of labor, rather than a kind of more practical recognition that people actually do have different skills.
From each according to his or her abilities to each according to his or her needs. Right?
Exactly.
Now, you've listed you did it in your talk yesterday, and you did this in your blog a couple of years ago, the sort of heritage of the New Left, which is very down on representation, the crime of speaking for others. We're very into pluralism. Everyone has to speak for him or herself. The idea of a party runs up against a lot of those things, right?
Right.
Tell us, talk some about these commandments that we've inherited from the New Left, you know, after all these years. For example, the crime of speaking for others, of representation. Like, why is that verboten, and why do we need to do that?
Yeah, so people, it's become a mantra, or it's been long a mantra on the New Left, don't speak for another person, only speak for yourself. And I think that there's some good reasons that was introduced, namely feminists in the New Left in the 60s and 70s were really tired, for good reason, of left men speaking for them. And they were like, no.
And that hasn't gone away.
And that hasn't gone away. And that's a real thing that people need to be in tune to. But that's not the same thing as saying that everyone can only speak for themselves, as if we can't make general claims, and as if we can't, like, I think it's good if men say, wait a minute, men, we should not be speaking for women, right? Or that, you know, I'll speak for the men here, and we've all been assholes, or something like that, right? So I think there are a couple of things here. I think that there were real criticisms that mattered when people tried to say, well, I can represent everyone. But then that goes to become so far where everyone can only speak for themselves, so that you can only speak from a position of experience, which also seems to require that, wait a minute, if I can't have a politics that is in favor, let's say, of, you know, more ramps for folks in wheelchairs because I've not experienced being in a wheelchair, that's got to be wrong. So I think that it's gone. I think it went too far to make it essentially so that you can only hear others. You can't ever learn from that and then change how you speak and what you say. And that you can only kind of hear and make experiential claims that prevent any kind of sort of generalization and building of, oh, we have a collective sense of a group. I know who we are. Now we're going forward.
There's also this kind of tyranny of the demographic where, you know, as a cis white male or as a black lesbian, like dot, 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 I can only speak for that particular demographic. I mean, that's related to this, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that's also it's a really sad mistake. It makes me start wondering, okay, so can I only speak for 51-year-old? I mean, basically, it means you can't speak. It's a silencing maneuver, right? You can't. It's a way to shut down speech, and I think ultimately prevent the emergence of commonalities and collectivities by pushing everything all the time towards fragmentation and really extreme individuation. I think that's the underlying politics here. And that may be a really unpopular thing to say, but it repeats the dominant mode of communicative capitalism, late neoliberalism, in strict personalization and individuation. Everything's got to be personalized to the nth degree, and that's what we've got to break out of.
Just like Facebook ads.
Yeah, just like Facebook ads. So Facebook ads targeting every little teeny little, you know, personal aspect of us, and then our politics ends up being, oh, only our most personal, detailed experience? No, that's wrong.
I'm speaking with Jody Dean, author most recently of The Communist Horizon, a professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges.
I saw Gautier Spivak speak a few weeks ago in the Bronx at the this Gramsci Monument, which is a remarkable event for many ways. But she said in her talk that democracy, proper democracy, there is no demographic. We're all individuals. We're not white. We're not black. We're not male. We're not female. That's what we should be aspiring towards. I mean, is that something like what you're thinking or not?
I guess. I mean, that's interesting. It's not exactly what I'm aspiring to, because I think that the emphasis on individuals is the wrong emphasis. I mean, I would much prefer to say that that a group that is democratic is first a group. It's first a kind of collectivity that is figuring out how to organize itself and how to make decisions for itself. And so I think that to begin with the emphasis on, you know, we're all individuals, I mean, I think the instinct behind what she's saying, you know, is good, but it's also eliminating a whole bunch of markers of belonging. And I think that the what happens in the extreme identity politics is a further elimination of markers of belonging because it anchors it in individuality. And she's doing a variation of that without the markers of belonging. What I would rather see in, you know, thinking about democracy is the emphasis on the collective, the solidary group, the shared and common matters that have to be determined and steered together.
How do you account for the popularity of anarchism on the radical American left? I mean, is it really just a species of American individualism? Is this the ghost of Emerson hanging over it?
It is that, but I actually think so few people in the U.S. know Emerson anymore, which is sad. I think it's the result of 30 years of neoliberalism, right? People get the message all the time, you're on your own, right? You have to do it yourself. You know, you're born alone, you die alone, you know, get in there, get what you can, make that money, you know, be unique, make sure you cultivate yourself so that, you know, you can be attractive to future employers or, you know, some kind of sexual companion or mate. And that the push on individualism is so prevalent and the critique of collectivizing institutions is so strong that a younger generation has picked this up and they don't like it, but the only radical language that they see is anarchism. And so that's what they go to. I mean, the effect of McCarthyism, Cold War, anti-communism, anti-socialism has been strong. And so I don't think for many young folks that they've seen socialism as a strong alternative. And so they want to be radical. And the one that fits, maybe even unconsciously with their own experience, is this one that keeps celebrating their uniqueness, but now makes it radical.
But then it sort of fits in with the DIY culture and Emersonian self-reliance.
Yeah, DIY, especially because you can't rely on the state to do it for you anymore.
Yeah, but it's funny. I was just thinking back on the Zuccotti moment when everyone was prefiguring a new society, but they had to send people out to Home Depot to buy tarps. I mean, they're not. It's not really clear how you scale up a society, a little society like that.
Yeah, absolutely right. And that's the thing that I think, going back to the party, that maybe if we start thinking in terms of party, we have to start thinking in terms of larger scale problems, larger scale solutions, working at the level of the state, working at the level of international trade, international flows. Work. I mean, like, what is it? Is it Mike Davis who talked about Walmart, or Mike Davis or Frederick Jameson? One of them saying something like, "Look, what Walmart may not be totally hideous. It could be a kind of large scale model."
They plan
organizing,
like crazy.
Right? I mean, that's something that's useful. I mean, I do think that you wouldn't have Walmart without, super bad factories. But if you thought about their ability to plan and scale and could change the relations of production and the what's produced, but still use their scale and distribution mechanisms, that's kind of cool.
I couldn't agree more. I was talking to somebody after your talk last night who had been in a small Trotskyist sect for a long time, and he said, "Well, we've been talking this way for a long time. We haven't gotten anywhere. What's different between what you're saying and what the Spartacist League might be saying?"
I think that actually, I do think that one sort of advantage disadvantage is that I'm not speaking from a party, and so it's not like I'm proselytizing for a specific organization. And I think that the small sectarian groups, part of the problem has been is they want people to join them, but only under they're already set very narrow conditions. They don't necessarily think about how do we join together with others. Instead, they think in a way like, how do we differentiate ourselves from others? And my hope is that, maybe now, essentially because there's no alternative, right? We are in, you know, we're facing austerity, privatization, the increased entrenchment of the 1%, the increased immiseration of the 99%. So if we think that, look, things will only get worse if we don't build a large counter power, then the effort has to be not how does each little party differentiate itself, but how do they pull together inside something like a coalition of the radical left or a new party?
Given the erosion of Occupy, now we've just celebrated its second anniversary, I don't see a whole lot of reflection on what lessons can be learned from the experience. A lot of people are still defending the agendaless, horizontalist model just as fervently. It's as if nothing has been learned from the experience of the last 2 years. When you travel around giving this kind of talk a lot, do you get any reaction from those sorts of people? Is there any willingness to listen and reconsider?
Yeah, I think so. And I think some folks are, you know, they in some ways a lot of the things that I say about, you know, the importance of a more transparent decision-making structure, more transparent leadership, clear leadership roles, criteria for membership, understanding of who's in the organization and who's out, some kind of planning. A number of those ideas I've gotten from actually talking to people from different Occupy groups and experiences who recognize, yeah, it, what was really exciting at the beginning stopped working. And we need to find a way to move forward.
Well, that's like the moment of first love, right?
Yeah, that's
right. That doesn't last, right? It's the first time you shoot heroin is the best, and you can never get that experience back again.
So, and the thing, and though a lot of folks do want to hold on to that experience because it was so magical and wonderful and transformative for them, and I think one of the problems that the small sectarian parties have is they haven't been able to provide that kind of experience to, you know, incoming people for a long time.
But now you said feeling, and I think that's important. A lot of radical politics seems to center on affect now, and certainly you need feeling in politics, but is that enough? What is the proper role of affect in political mobilization?
I think that's a great question, and I'm trying to work on that in my new stuff on crowd and party. Thinking about this is pretty provisional for me. I really think that the left, an organized left, should not let the right be the only source for political anger. And I think that the left needs to recognize that there's so many angry people. You know, furious about their loss of jobs, their extreme debt, their total cutting off of any opportunity, that they're angry. And if they don't see a visible left also angry and capable of organizing their anger, then they become more attracted to things like the Tea Party. So I think the left needs to take affect seriously, but not just in the, oh, we all feel so great, you know, because we're, talking about our feelings outside in a public square, but also think that, yeah, we can help steer anger. And then we can also take that initial anger and say, all right, we've got, here's a kind of program for trying to make change happen. Now, we don't have a program yet because we don't have a cohesive we yet, but I think that for the left to start thinking in terms of affects that are useful and making a plan and organizing towards reaching that plan would be a good step. And we haven't been thinking that strategically for a really long time.
And speaking of strategy, here we are in this country where this is, I think, an extreme case of this, where individualism is, you know, just in the air. One grows up with it. And then on top of that, we've had this, you know, new left bias against organization and this valorization of self-expression something. Politics is about self-expression and testimony and being righteous and all that. How do we get from here to there? I mean, how do we break out of this model and start thinking about some kind of collective organization? I mean, that almost the goal of thinking and acting collectively is almost what we're trying to do. We have like a, you know, right, like chicken and egg problem here.
Right. It's the way I think about it is, these days it's easier to imagine the end of capitalism than it is an organized left. Right. So we've got. So now
that's very common, too. I mean, you read all this literature like everything's on the verge of collapse. Now, I don't believe that for a second, but people do think everything's on the verge of collapse and that's going to be for our benefit.
And that's a crazy thing, right, to think that that collapse at this point would somehow be beneficial to the left rather than just real immiseration and suffering for a lot of people. So I am.
And the state has a lot of guns.
They have many more guns. Actually, at some point, we should have a real conversation about guns because I always wonder why it's the case that.
This is the southern girl in your country.
Let's repress that part of the conversation. So, on possibilities for getting from here to there, I think first one, if more people on the left start thinking we need a larger organization, that's already one step and a change. I think if existing small parties, there's been this debate happening over the last couple of years in the socialist press about trying to have the small parties merge and pull together, that there should be more effort and emphasis on that. I think that if you think there are really cool small projects of leftist publishers, websites, very small journals and groups, if they start forming themselves into a strong coalition and alliance, right, that would show young people where to go. So if let's say some of the real active groups like who are doing anti-foreclosure things, I mean, many of them still use the Occupy name, and that's great, right? They're visible. You know, Occupy Sandy was a great continued visible use of Occupy, of the Occupy name. That I think if a number of the committed active people start organizing themselves with a common name, then we start building a kind of symbolic infrastructure for, something like a party.
That was Jody Dean, professor of political science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges in upstate New York, and author most recently of The Communist Horizon. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Son of Pink's Get This Party Started. Next up is Kashama Sawant. She teaches economics at Seattle Central Community College and is running as an open socialist for a seat in the Seattle City Council. She won an impressive 29% of the vote in a race for the Washington State Legislature last year and decided to run for the City Council seat this year. Here she is to tell us about the race, the political economy of Seattle, and what her candidacies might mean for would-be candidates elsewhere. I've long thought that independent runs for president and other exalted offices were a waste of time and effort, and the real point of entry for radicals wanting to get involved in electoral politics is the local level, where a thinly funded candidate has an actual chance of being heard, and maybe even winning. Kashama Sawant.
Give me some idea how you got to this position of running for city council. You're not conventionally a politician, right?
No, I'm not. I'm a teacher and activist. And I'm a member of Socialist Alternative, which is a nationwide organization of social and economic justice activists. And last year, in the presidential election year, as the Occupy movement was winding down, we were confronted with the question of how do we continue to engage broader layers of people, people who weren't politicized yet, but still were thinking about these things. There is so much widespread outrage against inequality, against how the banks were bailed out and the rest of us were sold on the river. There's a lot of anger about foreclosures and evictions and low-wage jobs. And so, we decided to run an electoral campaign last year in order to be able to connect with people. And like you said, our campaign is completely different. And you know, people often tell us, progressives often say, well, you know, I like what you're saying, but, in terms of in the electoral arena, who do I vote for? I mean, there's a Republican or a Democrat, and I certainly don't want to vote for a Republican, and I know what you're saying about the Democrats, but what do I do? And so we decided to run that campaign last year as a way of giving people a real-life example. You know, this is what a grassroots campaign looks like. And we don't need to rely on the Democrats. We've been betrayed for decades with this two-party system. And it's high time that working people organize their own political alternative. And we can start in local politics as well. And so last year, we ran the campaign for the State House of Representatives in Washington. And we ran against the most powerful Democrat in the state, the House Speaker, Frank Chop. And we were able to get 29% of the vote, which represents over 20,000 people who voted for an open socialist. And we also happened to be the campaign that got more than double the votes that any of his previous opponents had ever gotten. And so that vote was so strong that it made it, and you know, we ran on a fraction of the money that he ran on. And so when we got the result last year, the question was, okay, so how do we take this forward? We thought that things are, you know, times are changing, people are looking for a change. And so that's, we, you know, decided to take that ahead and ran for this campaign for city council.
And what kind of district are you running in? What's the neighborhood like?
It's actually, these are all citywide races. These are at-large races. So we have to campaign in the entire city. So just to give you a sense of what Seattle is like, Seattle is, on the whole, if you look at public opinion, it is very, progressive. It's well to the left of what the city government represents. In general, I would say that's not different from the national average. I mean, if you look at opinion polls on most social and economic issues, people are well to the left of what Congress is. So I think that's pretty much the same in Seattle, although I would say that Seattle is, one of the most progressive cities politically and socially. As an immigrant, I feel very, very much at home here. But that's true, along with the fact that the city government's policies are very skewed towards the wealthy, towards big real estate developers, towards real estate investors. So in reality, what you see happening in the city is that there are two cities. There's one city that benefits disproportionately from cities' policymaking. You know, these are very high-income people who work in some of the high-tech industry, who are getting all the benefits of transit and other infrastructure, market-rate condos, and so on. And then on the other side, there's the rest of the city where most of the people of color live. You know, on the fringes of the city, very underserviced by transit and other infrastructures. I mean, they're not even, sidewalks are hard to find. And affordable housing is at a real crisis point in Seattle. So those are the issues we're grappling with.
And you don't hide the fact that you're a socialist. This is openly a part of your campaign.
Yes, absolutely.
And how do people receive that when you say that?
I think for the most part, the focus of people's attention when we talk to them, and we've been talking to hundreds, if not thousands, of people through our door knocking operation, and I personally being on the street and everything. And I would say for the most part, the focus of people's attention is on the campaign's program. You know, so we are the only candidate calling for $15 an hour. We're not just calling for 15, but we're fighting for $15 an hour. We've been picketing with other, fast food workers, and we've been part of the fast food strikes. And people look at that and say, oh, that I want that. I want somebody to fight for me for a change. And the other things we're calling for is a tax on millionaires to fund mass transit and education, and for rent control and other measures to address the need for affordable housing. So for the most part, people are looking at that. And I can tell you, sometimes I run into people who say, well, wait a minute, if you're the only one who's running on this sort of campaign, if you're a socialist, then maybe I'm a socialist. Maybe I need to look at this more carefully.
It does seem like the word has lost its capacity to scare people.
It has, actually, and especially for the younger generation. I mean, you know, the younger generation who are staring into a future of low-wage jobs and student debt and the old formula of, you know, keep your head down, work hard, go to college, get good grades, and then you're guaranteed a life of, you know, middle-class salary, a picket fence house, and you get your retirement and you get to send your kids to college. That formula, first of all, not that it worked for a majority of people, but it did create a significant layer of the middle class in the years that Paul Krugman calls the Great Compression. But since then, and especially since the economic crisis unfolded in 2008, there isn't that future for young people. And young people are now going to be the lost generation. And they can see that. You know, you don't have to have a degree in economics to know what you have at stake for your own future. And so it's not scary anymore. And not only that, I think, you know, people talk about socialism as, you know, as sort of the barometer. You know, if people are talking about socialism, times are changing, which is absolutely correct. But I have a different barometer. I would say that if people are naming the system today, you know, that capitalism is not working, then that's a sign of a sure shift away from the status quo, because then people say, okay, I'm not going to accept this as the only possible economic organization, because obviously it's not working for most of us. So what else lies out there? I want to find out. And so if you look at opinion polls, you know, I think the Pew Research Center did a poll on young people aged 18 to 30 years old, and I think a majority of them had favorable views of socialism and unfavorable views about capitalism.
But now, of course, you're not going out there and advocating the socialization of the means of production. I mean, you're just talking about very specific issues like increased wages and affordable housing and things that really speak to people's daily lives.
Yes, I mean, it's a twofold process. You know, we don't shy away from talking about what we mean by socialism, and obviously socialism is not simply carrying out these reforms, but it's also a question of, you know, how to bring people into the struggle, and one of the best ways to, you know, initiate that conversation is to talk about actual reforms. It's not just about talking about it, it's about actually fighting for the reforms. And what history often shows us is that, first of all, what would it take to win something like $15 an hour? You know, it's not going to be enough to have me on the city council. I mean, that would be a huge step forward, no doubt, because I will be strenuously and unapologetically advocating for it. But that won't be enough. What we will need is to rally a mass movement in the city around that demand. And what history has shown us is that that process of, you know, organizing a movement in solidarity with one another, fighting for the demand, understanding what factors are arrayed against you, how hard the establishment will fight against you to give you even the modicum of a standard of living. Those lessons that people learn through the process of fighting for a reform are very valuable in showing to people that, you know, wait a minute, it's not enough to fight for reforms. And plus, haven't we been fighting for reforms for decades? Haven't our ancestors fought for it? I mean, don't we need to take the movement forward? And for us, that's an opportunity to have that conversation with people that, yes, it's absolutely critical that we fight for these reforms, because look at our abysmal standards of living. But ultimately, if we want to address these problems that capitalism creates, poverty, homelessness, then we have to look at fundamental changes in the society.
I've long had the theory that it's good for radicals when there's a Democrat in the White House, because people start thinking about the system rather than the personnel. Do you find that at all?
I think that's true to some degree, in the sense that, you know, if a Republican was in the White House, then it makes it easier for the Democratic Party establishment to say, look, that's the problem, you know, that's that bad guy in the White House, and so you need to elect a Democrat. And it's complicated in the sense that, yeah, there are actually differences between the Democratic Party establishment. I mean, look at the dysfunctionality of the Republican Party and look at what's happening with the shutdown. But you're right that what's happened with the Obama administration, I think, is pretty instructive for us, because when Obama was elected first in 2008, there was such a huge groundswell of support. I mean, it was just an unbelievable momentum. It was not just, okay, I'm voting and that's it. There was this hope in the air. You know, it was electric. People were so convinced that it was going to happen. And we socialist alternative was very sympathetic to the, you know, hopes that progressives had, but, you know, we didn't shy away from saying that it's clear, you know, just from our analysis that the Democratic Party will not live up to those hopes, and they will be dashed. And 4 years later, that's what's happened. You know, people's hopes have been dashed, and they may continue. I don't think the illusions in the Democratic Party are entirely broken, obviously, but that does has had a huge impact. And so if you look at the fall in Obama's popularity among youth and especially black youth, it's been pretty remarkable. It's quite decisive that people are realizing that, well, wait, we had him in the White House, but what progress were we able to make?
Let's talk a bit about Seattle. In New York, I know that we have this, what we call sometimes the permanent government, which is Wall Street and real estate developers who essentially run the city, regardless of who the mayor and the city council are. What is the permanent government of Seattle? Who are the local ruling class? What do they look like?
I think the local ruling class are, as you said, in New York City, they are, you know, even here in Seattle, it's the real estate developers, and it's not just the developers. I mean, if you look closely at many of these transactions, actually, who's really behind it are real estate investors and banks, you know, basically the financial class that is bankrolling these real estate developments. And so they are the real moguls of this city. And I can name some particular ones. You know, there's developer named Richard Hedreen, who owns a lot of downtown property. He and his wife are major contributors to, you know, my opponent, the 16-year incumbent. He has been quite cutthroat in opposing unionization of some of the workers who are going to be working in the new hotels that he is planning to build in the land that he owns. But most of all, I think I would mention Paul Allen, the Microsoft billionaire. His real estate company, Vulcan, and through their subsidiaries, they own a large portion of Seattle's land. I mean, I remember I was at a radio interview at a left-wing radio station, and it's a small building, you know, sort of a nondescript building. And the host told me, by the way, this whole land and this building and this coffee mug you're using is owned by Vulcan. And it was quite striking that, you know, that these are the invisible landlords of the city. And so that's really who's running the show. And they rely very systematically on the city establishment to not only not create establishments for their, you know, profit-making enterprise here, but also to actively push for the things that they want. So you know, that's one of the reasons we're running against Richard Conlin, our opponent, because he's been the front man for Vulcan and the real estate developers. And what we see here is a major land giveaway to these millionaires and billionaires while people are struggling for affordable housing.
I'm speaking with Shama Sawant, who is running as an open socialist for a seat in the Seattle City Council.
And what about the tech people, you know, Microsoft, you mentioned Allen, but otherwise, are the tech people involved in Seattle politics at all?
Yeah, I mean, indirectly. I mean, you don't see them directly, but yes, in fact, a big rezoning of land that recently happened and that our opponent was almost single-handedly responsible for, you know, pushing through in the way that it went through, which was a major defeat for affordable housing. That's in a neighborhood called South Lake Union. And so, you know, people in Seattle will know when you talk to them about the South Lake Union rezoning. And the two entities that majorly benefited from that rezoning were Vulcan, what I mentioned, and Amazon.com. And that's another big player in this city. So there are no doubt, you know, quite a few high-earning, you know, high-tech workers here. But I wouldn't say that, I mean, they're benefiting from having, you know, very upscale condos that only they can afford, and by having a focus of infrastructure and development funding for the fancy neighborhoods they live in. But they're not running the show. The people who are running the show are the executives of Amazon.com and executives of Vulcan, you know, a lot of people whose names you don't know but are running the show behind the scenes. And then if you look at the larger picture of Seattle and you know, how Seattle operates in the state, the Boeing Corporation executives play a big role in, you know, deciding city and state policy and the fact that they pay very little in taxes. Same with Microsoft.
Okay, now let's talk a little bit more about your campaign. I imagine you're running it on a shoestring. How can you get the visibility that the better funded candidates can buy?
I think that there's no doubt that, you know, candidates that who are funded with massive amounts of money funneled by corporations are in a position to use traditional ways of reaching, you know, doing outreach. But what's happened in this race already is nothing short of historic, because if you look at our primary result, you know, we ran in a three-way race against two candidates who far outspent us. And, you know, we had to come in second in order to qualify for the general elections, which we did, which meant that we beat the other candidate who had raised a lot more money than us. And we not only made it into the general elections, we got 35% of the vote, which is just under 45,000 votes, which is a phenomenal result for a socialist campaign running on a shoestring budget, as you said. And I think what's happened is, you know, can be summed up what's happened is really a testament to changing times, because, you know, what is a traditional rule book? The traditional rule book is raise as much money as you can, you know, take money from whoever you want to, you know, don't use your principles there, you know, take money from big business, and go to Democratic Party establishment for endorsements and seek the support of the traditional, you know, sources. We essentially threw the rule book out of the window, and we said that, no, we are going to run a grassroots campaign. And it's not, for us, it's not just important that it's a grassroots campaign. What's important is that it's a grassroots campaign that is run independent of the Democratic Party establishment. And I think that's had a lot of impact on people's consciousness. Because, see, in Seattle, there is no complication of, well, you know, well, Republican versus Democrat, and Democrats may, you know, might be seen as a lesser evil. This is a one-party city. Seattle is a one-party city. It is controlled and dominated by the Democratic Party establishment. So they have no one else to blame. And people understand that. People understand that this is a Democratic affiliated city, and look at the state of affairs. And no doubt that we need a big change in the way the government is run. And it's our ideas that are having such a huge effect. And because they're having such a huge effect, we're also getting a lot of media attention. And so at this point, even though it's a mayoral race year, our race is getting probably the maximum attention, even compared to the mayoral race, because it's a very tight race. And it's really striking to people that, oh, but this insurgent socialist, you know, teacher activist is running against a powerful 16-year incumbent. He's probably, if not the most, one of the most powerful Democrats in the city. You know, he has these real estate developers in his pocket. And yet we are giving him a run for his money.
We have probably a few listeners to this show in Seattle, but not very many. But so I'm curious what lessons you would draw from your campaign for people who might want to try something similar in cities around the country.
I think the main thing we need to recognize on the left is that times are changing. And if people are sitting out there and listening to this show and thinking, wait a minute, what are you talking about? I'm pessimistic and I'm depressed, you know, Occupy wound down, and you know that's the way more movements go, and I have no hope. And I would like people to remember that that's the way movements go. You know, especially embryonic movements that are starting at an early stage, they work in ebbs and flows. I mean, look at the powerful confluence of social and political movements that happened in the 60s and 70s. On day one, they did not look like they looked when they were really exciting and really engaged the broad public. The anti-Vietnam War movement, the movement for women's reproductive rights, the Native Americans' rights, the Black Power movement, all these started small, and they needed pioneering activists to make personal sacrifices and work on them and, you know, really engage people. And those were the, you know, the just a day-to-day pavement pounding effort that made by millions of activists whose names we don't know that really made it happen. And I think If there is one lesson to be drawn, it's that, you know, to urge people to shed the cobwebs of the past and understand that we're in a new period. Capitalism's crisis is creating questions in people's minds. And if the left does not take advantage of this movement, and there's an open door here into people's consciousness, and if the left does not step in, the right will. In fact, the federal government shutdown is an excellent example of how a completely bizarre and out of touch idea, like the Tea Party, can take hold and really glom on to the dysfunctionality of the system and create this giant mess. Where is the left? Why is the left missing in all this? And how come we didn't take advantage of this? And we need to step into action.
And running for something like city council is a doable thing. That's something people should consider doing.
They should do it. I mean, there are people out there hungry for this sort of campaign, and they should do it, because even if the city council is not necessarily directly linked to national politics, what happens is that there is a domino effect of empowerment. If we were to win city council, and you know, we have a very good chance of doing that, imagine the impact on national politics. It will send shockwaves throughout the country. The socialist winning the city council seat in a large city, you know, running a large race on a shoestring budget, already it's gaining momentum. And the fact that we are having this conversation is a sign of the momentum our campaign is causing. And so we need those kinds of successes in other cities as well, because then people everywhere will wake up and say, hey, we can do this. If they did it, we can do it. And before you know it, there'll be a question that comes up that, you know, okay, so we have all these candidates running in different cities. Can we bring up the question of a mass political alternative for the working class and for working people? And that's the question we need to get to.
That was Kashama Sawant, a socialist candidate for city council in Seattle. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, the 14th of the Goldberg Variations by Johann Sebastian Bach, performed by Ralph Kirkpatrick. Till next week, bye.